Welcome to Business Daily and our latest delve into the world of chemistry as we break down the world economy element by element. And this week, we're looking at a yellow gas that is one of the most ferocious and frightening members of the periodic table.
If you smell fluorine, what you do is you run away as fast as you can.
But it is the other gases that can be made with this chemical element that pose the real threats to mankind. Everything from global warming to the risk of being fried by the sun.
They have lifetimes in the atmosphere ranging to thousands of years.
Yep, that's right. This week we are looking at fluorine.
Right, so we've come, as usual, to the laboratory of Professor Andrea Sella. So, Andrea, show me some fluorine.
I'm sorry. We haven't got any elemental, pure fluorine. And the reason is because fluorine's actually the Tyrannosaurus Rex of the periodic table. I mean, this is a tiger. It basically reacts with every element apart from helium. And so this is actually something we just don't routinely keep in the lab.
Tell me, what would it, if you had some, what would it look like? What is it?
Well, fluorine is a gas. It's got a pale yellow color. And apparently, it's got a smell a little bit like chlorine.
You say apparently, because clearly you've never smelt it.
I have smelt what comes out of a cylinder. And the thing is that you don't actually smell the fluorine. What you smell is the product of its reaction with oxygen. But generally, if you smell fluorine, what you do is you run away as fast as you can.
Okay, so fluorine is incredibly reactive, but if it's reactive, it reacts with substances to create materials which presumably are more stable. There must be some fluorine here.
Actually, there's a really important application for the acid associated with fluorine, and that's hydrofluoric acid. Now, I've got a bottle of it right here, and you can see that it says very toxic on the one hand.
It's got the usual skull. Under the skull, it says very toxic, which is unusual, because normally it's just toxic.
And then it says corrosive. And the reason this stuff is actually so bad is because if you actually get it on your skin, the molecules are so small that they can actually penetrate the skin directly. Once it's inside, of course, A, it's acidic, which means it's corrosive. But the second thing is that it reacts with any calcium or any magnesium, in other words, crucial minerals inside your body, and precipitates them, essentially as salts.
So it strips them out of your body.
So it strips them out, and it's an unbelievably painful burn, and one that you can't really treat because it's gone in.
And actually, there's a famous scene in the series Breaking Bad, right at the beginning of the first series, they have a bath of hydrofluoric acid and they dissolve a body in it.
Yes, indeed. And Breaking Bad, of course, is one of those series which has brought a mixture of glamour and horror, I think, to chemistry. But in many ways, that's really rather an unbelievable scene, because unless you were really completely protected from the hydrofluoric acid vapor, then the people dropping the body into this bath, right, would have actually suffered very severe burns. But with that extreme reactivity comes some real power, and that is the fact that hydrofluoric acid will actually etch glass. And so if you have decorative glass in your shower enclosure, for example, which has that sort of matte, milky color, or perhaps you've got little security coating actually on the windows of your car, that will be done by using hydrofluoric acid, which just kind of scrapes off a little bit of the smooth surface and gives us the goods.
Like so many of these really ferocious chemicals in this plastic bottle that you've got it in, it actually looks just, it could be water.
Well, it does. Let me just take the top off here.
Don't take the top
off. Oh, go on.
No, go on.
Oh, go on. Really, look inside.
No, I don't want to look inside.
I'm not chicken. Seriously, Justin, what we really ought to do is to go outside where I'll be able to show you some of the incredible applications of fluorine.
Excellent. Let's go. Put that bottle down. So, Andrea, why on earth have you brought me out into the middle of University College London?
Well, we're actually standing by the main transformer station, and it's here where the power grid meets UCL. There's 11,000 volts behind this door.
And a sign saying danger high voltage, danger of death. It all looks very frightening.
Indeed. And in small letters, it also warns us that there is SF6, sulfur hexafluoride. And sulfur hexafluoride is a crucial fluorine-based gas that's very important in a number of industries, including the electrical one.
Now, you've negotiated special permission for us to go through this very dangerous-looking door, haven't you?
Well, no one is allowed in here and has taken a whole series of emails and phone calls to get this. There are the transformers.
So we see the wires snaking in, and this big lump of metal, which is gently humming in a faintly ominous way, that's the transformer, is it?
Yes, and those are the things which are going to convert the 11,000 volts down to the power that's distributed across the university. Now, sulfur hexafluoride is crucial in all this because one of its functions is to prevent sparking.
Right, and you obviously don't want sparks because they're very dangerous.
They're incredibly dangerous. Your equipment will be destroyed.
Okay, so why sulfur hexafluoride?
Well, the result of this extreme reactivity of the element fluorine itself means that its compounds are staggeringly stable. They're essentially like rocks.
So hold on, this is really, really aggressive, but the compounds it produces are stable. There's obviously something, some chemical magic going on there. What's happening?
Well, what you're forming are very, very strong bonds. And secondly, they're actually quite short. And the result is that molecules which are surrounded by fluorine, like SF6, are a little bit like a tortoise or an armadillo. They're surrounded by a carapace of fluorine that you can't actually break through. And this makes sulfur hexafluoride perfect because it means that even in a situation where there might be a short circuit or a spark, it will essentially sit there inertly and protect things.
Now, there is a kind of fun aspect to sulfur hexafluoride, isn't there?
I'm not quite sure what you mean. I mean,
well, helium makes your voice squeaky, doesn't it? And sulfur hexafluoride lowers your voice, makes it much deeper, which obviously, this being radio, is something that, you know, I'd like to try.
Well, look, we're not going to do that. And we're not going to do that because sulfur hexafluoride is actually a molecule which in many ways I really hate. And the reason is because of its environmental impact. The very fact of it being unreactive means that if we release it into the environment, it takes a very, very long time to break down chemically. It's estimated that its half-life is about 3,000 years in the atmosphere.
Wow. Right?
But at the same time, sulfur hexafluoride is a very, very strong absorber of infrared light. And so sulfur hexafluoride is one of the most potent greenhouse gases that we might release, and therefore we've got to be very careful how we handle it.
Now, it's not the only fluorine-based compound that has an impact on the atmosphere, because, of course, we've all heard of chlorofluorocarbons.
Yes, chlorofluorocarbons are, in a similar kind of way, it's carbon which is surrounded by chlorine and fluorine. And again, these are very robust, inert, long-lived molecules. But on top of that, they're really nice because you can compress them and turn them to liquid, and then you can expand them and turn them to gas. That makes them perfect as refrigerants, for example, for air conditioning and for refrigerators.
And they were incredibly widely used, weren't they, for that purpose?
They were hugely widely used as refrigeration really expanded around the world in a big way in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And then it was realized that what these molecules were doing was actually attacking the ozone layer. And they were reducing this very effective filtering method that exists high in the sky above our heads, which actually cuts out some of the most dangerous radiation that comes from the sun.
And I remember when this kind of ozone hole was progressively appearing, and there were great worries about, you know, the damage to people's skin as a result.
And the concern was sufficient that there was an international agreement, which is called the Montreal Protocol, to phase out the use across the world. And this has been sufficiently effective that this year, in fact, we're really starting to see the first signs of actual recovery from this ozone hole problem.
Which we should say was actually unexpected, wasn't it? So that's actually amazingly fortuitous for the world.
And what it means is that we've had to find replacements for those chlorofluorocarbons.
And so what have we found?
Well, we've made chlorofluorocarbons, but with one or two hydrogens left over. And I have a bottle of one here. This goes under the trade name of Freon. This is Freon 21. It's actually in a metal canister, and it says here that it boils at 8.9 degrees. If I shake it...
Oh, yeah, you can hear a liquid inside.
Refrigerants are very clever. What you have is a substance which, when you compress it, will turn to liquid. It gets hot. And so at the back of your refrigerator, you've got those vanes which warm up, and that's where the heat is transferred out of the fridge. The substance is then passed through a tiny nozzle, and the nozzle allows the liquid to expand, and it cools down very, very substantially. And so a refrigerant is simply a material which can go from liquid to gas reversibly and very easily, which is what allows you to pump the heat from the inside to the outside world. And this is what's called a hydrochlorofluorocarbon. These have no ozone-destroying properties. Why? Because they are degraded before they get high enough in the atmosphere to be destroyed. But they do have a downside, and they are very potent greenhouse gases in themselves. And so as we have moved away from ozone-destroying molecules, we have actually replaced them with others, which, on the other hand, are actually very potent greenhouse gases. Now, another crucial use of fluorine is actually for uranium enrichment. And that's in the form of a molecule called uranium hexafluoride.
Okay, so why do you need fluorine in order to enrich uranium?
Well, the crucial thing is that fluorine is an element which allows you to transform, in some cases, solids into gases. So just as you can take solid sulfur, react it with fluorine, and get sulfur hexafluoride, a gas, you can take uranium and react it with fluorine to get the gas uranium hexafluoride. And the gas allows you to separate the different isotopes of uranium, and particularly to enrich in 235, the one which is needed to split the atom and to get nuclear power. The way this is done is because although uranium-235 and uranium-238 have identical chemical properties, their masses are very slightly different. And so that means that a molecule containing uranium-235 will move fractionally faster than a molecule containing uranium-238.
And that's why you hear about centrifuges being used in uranium enrichment, because they separate out these different weights of molecules.
So weirdly, this isn't, in a sense, a chemical separation. This is really a separation based on physics.
Wow. Now, the word fluorine is familiar to me, not because of uranium enrichment, because I associate it with my toothpaste. Now, am I right to be doing that?
Absolutely. What we're talking about here is fluoride, and that's what you get when you take fluorine and you react it with a metal. You end up with these fluoride ions, and it turns out that trace amounts of this introduced either into toothpaste or into the water supply seem to protect people against tooth decay.
What do you mean seem to protect? It says on my toothpaste, clinically proven.
Well, there's a huge amount of controversy around this, and I'm being a little cautious. Certainly, clinical studies suggest that it protects people against tooth decay, and yet there is a very, very intense movement which is very suspicious of this and worried about water and other things being tampered with.
Do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever had to face?
But fluoride is interesting because it doesn't protect your teeth by actually killing the bacteria, but it's actually by reacting with your teeth and producing fluorides of calcium. And I've got here a little bit of calcium fluoride, and you can see that it's a beautiful, glossy material.
That is
right?
Calcium fluoride.
That is calcium fluoride.
I mean,
fluoride.
You would imagine that was glass. I mean, it's see-through. There are a few bubbles, kind of it's, impurities in it, but it's a lovely, quite heavy bit of glass, I would have said.
Well, it looks like glass, but this is actually a salt of calcium and fluorine. And the beauty is that you can dip this into water and it doesn't dissolve. And so in a sense, what the fluoride is doing is it's reacting with the calcium and it's producing a layer which essentially protects the teeth against attack. And so once again, although the element is so ferociously reactive, once you've combined it into a compound like calcium fluoride, it is really completely inert and it doesn't do very much. And a great example of that is, of course, Teflon. And, you know, you might think that I would have brought you a frying pan.
I was looking around for the frying pan.
You're looking around. But instead, I've actually brought some ribbon. Now, this has been machined off a piece of solid Teflon to make some scientific equipment.
Yeah, and it feels soft and plasticky.
The beauty of it is that it's extremely unreactive. You can form Teflon, for example, into tape. And so plumbers will use Teflon tape. And you can see that it's rather nice and stretchy. And it will provide useful seals between metal components to prevent leaks.
Now, I must say, this feels like a plastic, and I'm sure you're going to tell me it is a kind of plastic, but made with fluorine.
It is a kind of plastic. It's, in fact, a polymer with the structure CF2, PTFE, polytetrafluoroethylene. And, of course, it's important for me every time to introduce a cycling link, but here we have a classic bicycle lubricant, which actually contains some PTFE, it says, and it says it's a penetrator and water displacer. And so you can spray this onto the chain of your bicycle to essentially protect it from rust, from water, and to keep it lubed.
Well, as you can hear, we've left University College and Professor Andrea Sella gassing on, as always, and we've come to the source of fluorine, to a mine in Derbyshire. And I'm with Richard Ellis, who's a geologist with British Fluorspar, the company that mines here. But Richard, they call you Fred, yeah?
Yeah, that's right.
So where are we now?
You're on Longston Edge in the middle of the Peak District. We've got a vein structure here that runs for 1.5 miles. I was a boy just over the hill from here. This was being worked in the 50s. So this has been worked for nearly 60 years.
So the Peak District, it's a very beautiful part of Britain. It's a national park in the centre of the country. Lovely rolling heather-topped hills. You're mining in the middle here. But why do we find fluorspar, the mineral that contains fluorine, here in the Peak District?
Because it's crystallised out into the fractures that were opened up some 250 million years ago.
So this is a limestone rock, aren't
they? This is limestone rock. The rock fractured, and then about 150 million years ago, you had your mineralising brines came.
So this is seawater you're talking about?
Yes.
So seawater came in...
Yeah, the theory is that it was compaction in the North Sea basin, forced the mineralising brines...
So forced the water through the rock?
Yep, until it reached this particular part of the country where it crystallised out.
So basically this hot water was pumped through the rock, it got here, it began to cool, and as it cooled it formed crystals.
Yep.
And what we find here are crystals of fluorspar containing fluorine.
Yes.
Now, where we're standing is a great kind of canyon created for the mining. We can hear a great digger working away there. There's a dumper truck taking away material here. We're standing on the rubble in the floor of the canyon. Can you see any fluorite here?
Yes.
Find some for me, please,
Fred. Find
some
crystals.
Is there any here? Let's have a look. What about this?
Yep. You see there, you've got nice banding. There's a little bit of black limestone, but the crystalline clear mineral is fluorite.
This isn't the most beautiful crystals. What proportion of that would be fluorite?
85% to 90%.
Wow, so it's pretty pure. So when was it first discovered that fluorspar was a useful mineral?
In the 19th century, they could use it as a flux in the metal industry.
Now, a flux, you mean something that reduces the temperature at which metals melt, is that right?
Yeah.
So it made it easier to work it in the iron industry.
Yes, and it also helped get rid of the slag as well.
So first of all, people started mining fluorspar here to take down to the great iron and steel industry that grew up in places like Sheffield.
Well, Sheffield's only, 15 miles away from here. That's where you had all your steel mills, so it was easy access for them.
And in fact, it got its name from the role it plays in the metal industry, doesn't it?
That's right, yes. Flux.
So it comes from the Latin word flux, which means flow.
Yeah.
And because it helped the metal flow more easily.
That's right.
It got the word fluorine.
Yeah.
But it's also had an influence elsewhere in language, hasn't it? Because it's also the source of another word. And I'm going to see if we can find out why that is. I've got a UV torch here. We've got a bit of fluorite that we've just pulled up from the ground. Let me see whether it fluoresces, but it isn't fluorescing. But some deposits of fluorite do fluoresce, don't they?
Yes, they do, particularly Weardale.
And that's where the word comes from. Well, a little bit of a landslide behind us. But ironically enough, fluorine itself isn't fluorescent.
No, but it's because of the impurities, that's why it fluoresces.
There are different grades, aren't there,
of calcium
fluoride? Yeah. So what are the differences?
We produce acid-grade fluorspar. For that, the final product needs to be 97% CaF2. Metspar, for the steel industry, doesn't need to be as pure as that. You're talking in the 80%.
Well, essentially, for the metal stuff, you just need to crush a bit of rock like this and you could send it down to the foundries to be used now.
It used to be said that it was so pure, it was loaded on lorries straight to the steel industry in Sheffield.
But the fluorspar that you produce here doesn't go into the steel industry anymore. So what is it used for?
It makes hydrofluoric acid. It goes to the processing plant, who ends up as a fine white powder.
So the ore that we saw in the quarry is brought here, it's crushed, the calcium fluoride is taken out in a kind of foam, and it ends up in this great drum that you can hear in front of me now, and it comes off like wet sand, and this is the final product of the quarry.
Well, we're about 80 kilometres away from the mine now, and I'm on a huge chemical plant, one of the biggest plants in Britain, at Runcorn. It's a wonderful site with huge towers, with silver chimneys and all sorts of beguiling equipment. And I'm here with Ron Rocher of Mexichem, and you run the fluorine plant here, don't you?
Yeah, I look after the production at Runcorn site, so we actually get the product calcium fluoride in a very fine powder.
And then it's pumped into this kind of vast chemistry set that you've got down here.
Absolutely. So the objective is to gain access to the fluorine.
So how do you move this grey-white powder into this vast kind of plant that you've got here? Because it must be, what, 40 metres high, maybe 100 metres long? I mean, it's an incomprehensible kind of tangle of pipes and columns and stuff. You can't make any sense of it. Do you understand it?
Yes, we clearly understand it very well. Basically, it's delivered here in tankers, and then it's blown up.
So there's a great... Can I pick this up?
Don't
pick it up. There's a magnificent steel pipe that you use. Presumably you bolt it into the tankers, and then that conveys the powder up in the airstream, up into the huge kind of hopper you've got right at the top.
At the top, absolutely. So from the silo, we basically gravity feed the fluorspar into the pre-reactor, which effectively can only be described as a large mixing screw. There we add sulfuric acid and start to commence the reaction to produce hydrofluoric acid.
So we're talking about some pretty aggressive chemistry here, aren't we?
Absolutely. It requires very precise control and also very precise selection of materials of construction for the building of the asset.
So this mixture now of sulfuric acid and fluorspar then travels into a huge kiln. It makes up most of the kind of length of your plant.
The kiln itself is about 57 metres long, and while it operates, it rotates between 1 and 2 revolutions per minute. The process itself is an endothermic reaction, so the kiln has also got a hot gas jacket around its full length, so we can supply heat to keep the reaction going.
Endothermic means it needs heat in order to take place, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Right, okay.
Basically, the calcium fluoride is broken up. Hydrogen combines with fluorine to form hydrofluoric acid, and then calcium combines with sulfate to form calcium sulfate. The hydrofluoric acid is in a gas form, and the calcium sulfate exit the back end of the kiln as a solid.
Now, the gas is, again, quite a kind of potentially nasty chemical, so you need to be quite careful with that, presumably.
HF is both toxic, corrosive, and needs to be handled very carefully.
Now, you work for Mexichem. Indeed, this plant is owned by Mexichem. Mexichem, as the name suggests, is a Mexican chemicals company, and it's the biggest fluorine producer in the world, isn't it? Why is Mexichem so big in fluorine?
We've got the world's largest fluorspar mine at St. Louis Potosi, where we produce over 1 million tonnes of fluorspar a year.
So it's built up around this incredible deposit there is down in Mexico.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've come up into the office, and I want to get a sense of the scope of fluorine as an industrial chemical, because it's in an incredible range of products, isn't it?
Absolutely. In the industrial sector, HF is used in smelting aluminium, in refineries, as a product that actually improves the efficiency of conversion of crude oil to high-octane petrol. It's used in etching printed circuit boards, the manufacture of lithium fluoride and fluoride batteries.
But it's also, HF is this feedstock, isn't it, for the fluorocarbon process. What are fluorocarbons and what are they used for?
Well, the fluorocarbon chains actually, again, derive a huge range of different products. So we're a world leader in the manufacture of medical-grade propellant gases.
So those are the gases used in kind of asthma inhalers, those kind of things?
Absolutely.
And you've got one here, haven't you? And this uses your propellant. Let's listen to it.
Now, in the old days, the propellant used was CFCs. Obviously, it was discovered those were damaging the ozone layer. This was the kind of ozone-friendly alternative, wasn't it, to CFCs?
Yes, which we developed, and we established the first production plant here at Runcorn site.
All of your company's production of this product is made here, isn't it? And in fact, it's a huge share of world market.
Yeah, we supply approximately 75% of the world's metered-dosed inhalers.
But actually, inhalers are a tiny proportion of fluorocarbon products, because fluorocarbons are also the basis of most refrigerants, aren't they?
Yeah. In addition, it's used in solvents and aerosols, anesthetics, and surfactants.
That's not the end of it, is it? Because you've also got fluoropolymers, which are used in the plastics industry, aren't they?
Yeah. So, as an example, the non-stick coating on frying pans.
And we've got one here. So that's Teflon, isn't it?
Teflon, effectively as a brand name, PTFE is actually the product that's used to make that coating. ETFE is used to make specialist films and roofs. So here we've got the stadium in Munich.
So the Allianz Arena, which is where Bayern Munich play, isn't it? And it's the most phenomenal plastic ring, basically, which lights up and looks amazing, actually. And that's using your products, is it?
Produced with the feedstock that we produce here on this particular site, yes.
And there's another whole category of foam-blowing products. These are those kind of insulating plastic foams that you see builders spraying into cavities and that kind of stuff.
Yes, we supply gases for foam blowing. Because of their inert characteristics, it means that they can be used with other products. It allows the foam to be blown into position in very intricate and difficult positions to get to.
So in a sense, you know, it's the question more is what is fluorine not in? Then what is it in? I mean, this is an incredibly important industrial feedstock, isn't it?
Fluorine really does form a critical backbone for a very wide range of industrial and domestic products that actually feature quite heavily in all of our day-to-day lives.
That was Ron Roscher, Operations Manager at Mexichem's Fluorine Works in Runcorn. You are listening to an Elemental Economics special on Business Daily, and today it is all about fluorine. We've heard about some of the very helpful uses of fluorine-based chemicals, but as Andrea mentioned, this halogen has also been responsible for an array of gases that have been doing rather nasty things to our atmosphere. To find out more, I spoke to Dr. Stefan Ryman, who tracks so-called F-gas emissions on behalf of the World Meteorological Society.
F-gases are hydrofluorocarbons. They are used in refrigerants, in foam blowing. Another type of F-gases are sulfur hexafluoride, which is used mainly in electrical switch gears, and perfluorocarbons, which are produced when you, for example, produce aluminium. Then you also produce CF4, carbon tetrafluoride, which has an extremely long lifetime of 50,000 years. And the more stable a gas is, the more potential it has to also to act as a greenhouse gas. And that's exactly what's happening with these F gases, because they have lifetimes in the atmosphere ranging from about 10 years to thousands of years. But they act in a different region of the atmosphere than CO2, and therefore they're really, really powerful. And for example, one of these F gases is used in air conditioners of the cars, and 1 kilogram released of this substance has the same effect as more than 1,000 kilograms of CO2.
Wow, so they can be very powerful, and some are even more powerful global warming gases than that.
Yes, so the most powerful is sulfur hexafluoride. It has the same effect as 20,000 kilograms of CO2. So we really have to see that we don't release too many of these substances into the air.
And it's worth noting here that chlorofluorocarbons, which obviously were famous for destroying the ozone layer, are also F-gases and also had a strong global warming effect as well, didn't they?
Yes, and that was a really good thing that we had this Montreal Protocol banning CFCs from usage, because that really created the biggest effect we have had for climate until now. These chlorofluorocarbons, they have lifetimes of 50 to 100, even longer years in the atmosphere until they get destroyed. And the effect they have now, it's about 14% of the whole greenhouse effect.
Hold on, so 14% is from previous use of CFCs?
Yes, that's it.
Before they were banned?
Yes.
And that's going to be true. I mean, that effect is going to go on for decades, if not, 100 years.
Yes, so it's slowly going down because we don't release this stuff anymore. Still, we have to live with that, yeah.
Well, hold on. So, weren't CFCs as refrigerants replaced by other F-gases?
Yes, mainly. But for some applications in some regions of the world, for example, in Europe, the fridges, they're not filled with F-gases anymore, but hydrocarbons. And hydrocarbons don't destroy the ozone layer and don't contribute a lot to climate forcing. And the usage of the HFCs was really reduced in comparison to the CFCs.
But overall, the use of F-gases is rising, isn't it? And actually, an increasing proportion of the global warming effect now is coming from F-gases.
Yeah, that's true. So at the moment, this effect is really small. So these F-gases have about 1 to 2% effect in total. But developing countries, they also have big needs in these F-gases. For example, air conditioners in China or in India. Every flat has more or less an air conditioner in front of the window in Beijing, for example. And it's expected we could end up having about 20% of the greenhouse effect related to these F-gases in about 2050.
Wow, that is really significant, isn't it? Mm-hmm, so are there any options, are there alternatives of getting the same effects as these gases but which don't have the global warming potential?
So there's a new type of F-gas which industry is producing right now called HFOs, hydrofluoroolefins. They have really an advantage that they get destroyed within some weeks if they leak out in the atmosphere. There is a little bit of disadvantage here as well, that they get destroyed to a substance called trifluoroacetic acid in soils and rivers.
So there are worries that there might be pollution from these new gases?
It's just a worry at the moment because nobody really knows how much they will be used. But I think it should be really worth that people look very closely what's happening in the environment to the substances then.
So if you had to look ahead, do you think we're going to find a solution to the kind of F-gas problem?
Yes, I hope so. It's a matter of price. It's a matter of research. But if industry could produce an F-gas, which is destroyed within weeks in the atmosphere and which then doesn't produce any stable product out of this destruction, I think that would be the holy grail of F-gases somehow. Then.
Well, this would be a huge step forward in terms of the battle against climate change, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think so, because I think you can get people on board working against climate change as long as they don't have to change their lifestyle.
Now, listen, what I don't understand is in almost all the applications of F-gases, the gas itself is contained, and that's the point. You know, for example, in a refrigeration unit, it's contained. Now, why can't we just make sure that the gas doesn't leak into the environment?
It's contained more in the fridge which you have in your house. But if you have a car, the car is moving. And that really leads to the fact that about 10% of this fluid which is contained in this air conditioner is actually leaking out into the atmosphere. If you estimate this on a global basis, it's about 160,000 tons.
And as you say, it's many times the power in terms of global warming than CO2. So figure has to be multiplied many, many times. People who have cars with air conditioners will know that every now and then you have to recharge the air conditioning unit, and presumably that's replacing lost gas.
That's exactly what's happening, yeah.
That was Stefan Reimann of the Swiss Federal Laboratories for Materials Science and Technology. Well, man's history with refrigerant gases is an unfortunate one, and none more unfortunate than Thomas Midgley Jr., the American chemist who first developed CFCs back in the 1920s. Midgley was also the man who put lead into leaded petrol. But as Stefan mentioned, the chemicals industry has now come up with a new, more global warming-friendly substitute refrigerant, HFOs. Yet this new breed of F-gas has not been without controversy. In 2012, Daimler claimed one of its Mercedes cars burst into flames during a test of the new product. So what's going on? Well, Daimler were not available for comment, so instead I got hold of Ian Shankland, who led the team at the US chemicals giant Honeywell that played a leading role in developing HFCs and HFOs. But first, I gave him the opportunity to defend the record of his forerunner, Thomas Midgley.
Why were CFCs ever invented? If you go back to the 1920s, refrigeration and air conditioning in homes and buildings was just not common. there were accidents and people died in their homes from fires or poisoning from the refrigerants that were used at the time. They were flammable like hydrocarbons, toxic like ammonia, or flammable and toxic like methyl chloride. There were many documented instances. What the world needed then was a safe, non-flammable, highly energy efficient material so that mechanical refrigeration and air conditioning could be used. And that was, if you like, the genesis of CFCs. They had all those properties.
But they did have those very, very damaging side effects,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah, the side effect came because of one of their very positive attributes. They're very chemically stable. Their strengths come from the fact that the carbon fluorine bond is the strongest single bond between two atoms in organic molecules. And so if they leaked into the atmosphere, they would not react with any of the components of the atmosphere, and they would diffuse to the stratosphere. They lived for very long times, maybe a half-life of hundreds of years. When they got to the stratosphere, intense ultraviolet radiation would break the molecule apart, releasing chlorine atoms in the CFC. And the chlorine atoms catalytically degraded the Earth's protective ozone layer.
So what was the response?
First and foremost was to remove chlorine from the molecule. And then if you leave some hydrogen on the molecule, you actually provide a mechanism for the molecule to degrade in the atmosphere and thereby reduce its atmospheric lifetime. And by that mechanism, we had the hydrofluorocarbons, half-lives of a decade versus half-lives of a century.
So these are HFCs, hydrofluorocarbons. So a different molecule, but again, fluorine at the heart of it.
Correct, yes.
But there were issues with HFCs, weren't they? Because they have a potential for global warming, don't they?
Yes, that same carbon-fluorine bond absorbs in the infrared wavelengths, and therefore CFCs were very, very potent greenhouse gases. HFCs are less potent greenhouse gases, but they are still strong greenhouse gases. And to put that in perspective, HFC-134a, which is used in automobile air conditioning primarily, it has a global warming potential of 1,400.
Which led to the development of a new kind of fluorine-based molecule.
Yes, a similar strategy as in the development of the HFCs was to further reduce the atmospheric lifetime, now to days. So the half-life is measured in a two-week time frame. By including a double bond in the molecule, it reacts very, very quickly in the atmosphere. So now that same global warming potential number is less than one for some of these molecules.
Now, there are environmental effects, aren't there? So HFOs, as they're known, they leave a byproduct, don't they, called trifluoroacetic acid in soils.
Not all of them. Some of them do, as do a number of the HFCs that have been used for the past two decades. When the HFCs were developed, the industry and academics looked at the environmental impact and discovered that there's much more trifluoroacetic acid in the environment today than can ever be accounted for by all of fluorochemical production. So there has to be a natural source that's believed to be formed below the ocean in volcanic vents. And the amount of trifluoroacetic acid produced from these HFO materials is much smaller than the naturally occurring background levels.
So is that a problem?
The best science today says that it is not a problem, no.
But then there was this disastrous test by Daimler, the car manufacturer, wasn't there, when they tested it as a refrigerant for car air conditioning systems and discovered that it produced hydrofluoric acid when it came into contact with moisture. But even more seriously, it had the potential to produce phosgene gas. Now, phosgene gas is famous as one of the gases used during the First World War in the trenches. Now, you wouldn't want that released in your car, would you?
No, well, I think there's a couple of things that you mentioned there that are actually technically incorrect. What Daimler discovered was, in their viewpoint, that the molecule would burn in certain situations if there was a leak underneath the hood, the bonnet of a car. We respectfully disagree with their conclusion because, you know, this molecule has undergone 10 years of testing, not just by us in our lab, but also by the whole automobile industry independently of us, and they reached the conclusion that it was a safe material.
But Daimler, they say that it is a fire hazard and it released these toxic gases during tests. I mean, you have to admit that it sounds quite frightening.
I think we need to put it in perspective. Those two toxic materials they're talking about, when any fluorocarbon is combusted in a fire, let's say there's a car fire, even the current refrigerant will be combusted. Even the old CFCs would be combusted. During that combustion process, certain amounts of hydrofluoric acid are possible to form. If I compare the new molecule versus the 134A, the old molecule, we get exactly the same amount of hydrofluoric acid. So if there is a problem on that aspect for the new molecule, there would have had to be a problem with the old molecule that's been used for over 20 years. And I don't know of any single instance of anyone reporting any exposure to hydrofluoric acid from a car fire.
So why are they making this issue then?
I don't know why they're raising the issue. I think that's better asked of Daimler. The other one on phosgene, the chemical formula of phosgene is Cl2CO. There's no chlorine in the new molecule or even an HFC, so you cannot form phosgene.
Well, let's go through the history of the use of these HFO products. I'm right in thinking, aren't I, that in 2006, the EU issued a directive which required that companies phase out the use of HFCs for air conditioning in cars, starting in 2011.
Correct, yes.
And this is something that Germany has repeatedly protested against and asked for special exemptions not to apply the directive.
That's what I believe Germany has done, yes.
Now, their opposition to your product, I think, is partly to do with the price, because they say, look, it's 10 times more expensive than the HFC product. And what's more, it's owned exclusively by yourselves, Honeywell, and the pharmaceutical company DuPont, who developed the product. Is that right?
Honeywell and DuPont own a number of different patents on the use and manufacture of the molecule.
Daimler's position is they feel as if they're being forced to use this expensive product, which is kind of exclusively owned by two major chemical companies.
No one's forcing Daimler to use this material. Daimler indeed have said they don't want to use it, and they are pursuing carbon dioxide as a refrigerant.
So you'd reject Daimler's arguments and say, listen, this is a good product, you should use it in your cars.
We believe it's a good product. There's over 2 million cars on the road today using it effectively and safely.
That was Ian Shankland of Honeywell, and that brings us to the end of this week's programme. But if you want to download a longer version podcast of this and others in our Elemental Economics series and read a series of in-depth articles, then go to bbc.com/elements. And tune in next week when we'll be looking at an unnatural element that you've probably never heard of, but which is at the cutting edge of medical diagnosis. Gas, gas, gas.